know, it's the governor. He can call us in here, but he can't tell us where our committees are going to meet.
The legislature votes to take a break from Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 30th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage School District plans cuts to positions.
When you get to this point of $17 million that you have to cut on top of the, you know, reductions that we already had to address the prior years, there's no way around it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
While Governor Bill Walker has ordered the legislature hold its special session in Juneau, lawmakers may have found a workaround. He can't control where they hold their committee meetings or how often they have their floor session. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the Republican majorities have moved to take a recess while continuing their committee work on the road system.
Since the special session went into effect on Tuesday, the issue of where and when the session is held has taken up about as much time as anything on the session agenda. On Wednesday, the governor denied a request from legislative leadership to relocate the session to Anchorage. And now, on Thursday, the House and Senate voted to stop holding floor sessions in Juneau for the next 2 weeks.
You know, it's the governor. He can call us in here, but he can't tell us where our committees are going to meet.
House Speaker Mike Chenault says the resolution allows the finance committees to hold hearings in Anchorage if they choose. That's something they could not do without a recess. Under the legislature's rules, lawmakers must meet in the main House and Senate chambers and hold floor sessions as a whole body every 3 days at minimum. That basically chains them to Juneau. House Majority Leader Charisse Millett carried the resolution to waive that rule.
What it means is we won't have House floor sessions until the 12th. That's all this means. Every other business will continue on, but we won't come to this floor and push buttons when we don't have a budget bill in front of us.
The budget is one of three items on the special session agenda, with Medicaid expansion and a bill establishing a sexual abuse prevention program in schools making up the rest of the call. Millett noted that negotiations on a budget have been at a stalemate. During the regular session, the legislature was only able to reach an agreement to pay for government operations through the fall. That's because the Republican majority needs some Democratic support to get access to the state's rainy day fund. But the House Democratic minority has made Medicaid expansion a condition of their vote.
It's an impasse. A lot of times, when you're negotiating a contract, what do you do, Mr. Speaker? You take a break, right? Take a break. Cool off. And so what we're asking to do is not take a break, but we're asking to change the conversation from here to Anchorage or on the road system somewhere where we can all talk about what's happening.
The divide on the recess resolution broke on caucus lines. Some Republicans noted that construction was being done on the Capitol building, making for less than ideal working conditions. With heavy machinery beeping in the background, Juneau Democrat Sam Keto said that the city had other venues available if needed. He added that lawmakers should be able to reach an agreement on a budget if they just stick around a little bit longer.
I think we are down to the last couple of items in negotiations for the operating budget. I don't think that we need to take any kind of a roadshow out there right now.
But Representative Benny Nagyak, a Barrow Democrat who caucuses with the Republican majority, emphatically disputed that. Since Nagyak is not in leadership or on the Finance Committee, he says he's had to miss part of whaling season all to sit on the sidelines.
We've been here for a few days. Nobody's budging. Nobody's budging and nothing is being done. And right now, in my hometown, and all along the coast, from Barrow to Point Hope. They're doing the thing that we've been doing for generations upon generations, and I'm missing that.
The recess resolution passed 24 to 13. In a press conference, Governor Bill Walker said he would not take further action on the session's location. He did, however, say he was disappointed.
I'm disappointed. At the same time, I'm disappointed that so many are leaving at a time when I think we could be close to bringing this to a resolution.
Walker noted that if the state does not manage to pass a fully funded budget that pays for government for the whole year, Alaska's credit rating could be at risk. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Matanuska Susitna Borough officials got an early look at the borough's FY 2016 spending plan today. Borough manager John Moosey opened the discussion, saying the budget would be very conservative compared with previous years. The borough's mill rate has remained relatively flat since 2010, but Moosey says changes are coming.
We can't continue this for this budget. If you look back at 2009, what we're charging to taxpayers and where we are now, what other organization, business, can say we're doing more things, we're growing, and we're still charging you less, charging taxpayers less, 7 years later? My message today is we need to make some changes, especially revenue changes, because some of the revenue that we are counting on and some of the things that we created are really making at a pinch point.
No individual department heads presented figures to the Assembly at today's work session. The Assembly prioritizes spending and will deliberate the plan after a series of public hearings starting on May 4th. Moosey said along with the budget debate, there needs to be further discussion regarding deficits in the funds that pay for select borough operations, namely Port McKenzie, Borough Solid Waste Services, and the unused ferry Susitna. Those so-called enterprise funds are supposedly supported by fees charged for services, but there are wide gaps between costs and charges, Moosey said. Borough Finance Director Tammy Clayton.
With regards to the port, the budgeted deficit for June 30th, 2015 is estimated at $6.8 million. The budgeted deficit for June 30, 2016 is estimated at $6.35 million. The ferry, or what's approved to be transferred in for fiscal year 2016, is $460,000.
State fiscal woes also are affecting the borough's budget for the next fiscal year. Moosey said a drop in revenue sharing, increases in school infrastructure needs, and a drop in borough revenue due to senior and disabled veteran tax exemptions are all contributing to the lean fiscal outlook. The Anchorage School District plans to cut 57 currently filled positions next year because of a $16.7 million budget cut from the state legislature. That includes 37 classroom teachers and 12 literacy coaches. They will also eliminate the 23 new positions they added into next year's budget and all of the pilot programs focused on early learning and updating science teaching tools. Superintendent Ed Graff says they didn't want to eliminate the new programs or the teachers.
But when you get to this point of $17 million that you have to cut on top of the, you know, reductions that we already had to address the prior years, there's no way around it. It's going to have an impact on everything that we do.
Graff says the school board must vote on the cuts on Monday because they need to inform tenured teachers about layoffs by May 15th and other staff by the end of the school year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, changes to the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act.
H.R. 1335 would take us back to the dark ages by gutting science-based requirements to rebuild overfished stocks and to set annual catch limits.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska State troopers say that both men involved in a shooting on April 18th have died. Troopers say 57-year-old Billy Kidd of Willow died of his injuries in an Anchorage hospital. Previously, Kidd had been listed in critical condition. The other man, 33-year-old Andre LaFrance, died at the scene of the incident and was identified shortly thereafter. According to the trooper report, Kidd called 911 shortly before 1 a.m. on Saturday, April 18th, and reported he had just killed someone. It took troopers hours to find the scene in the Montana Creek area by using information from Kidd's cell provider. When they arrived, LaFrance was deceased and Kidd was in critical condition. Based on the investigation so far, troopers believe Kidd shot and killed LaFrance, then shot himself. No information on events leading up to the shooting has been released as of today. Troopers say that the next of kin for both Billy Kidd and Andre LaFrance have been notified. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Beth Ipson says the investigation will continue. In an email statement, she says reports are still being written and results from evidence tests to analyze. Ipson adds there are likely many questions that will not be answered, since the only two men believed to be at the scene are now deceased. In Congress today, the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee moved a bill to renew the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the nation's bedrock fisheries law. The sponsor, Alaska Congressman Don Young, says the law has kept foreign fishing fleets off America's shores and sustained healthy fisheries.
And we're trying to maintain the integrity of the original act by adding some smaller changes. The smaller changes are flexibility.
The bill has alarmed some small-scale fishermen and conservationists. They say the bill undercuts a key element of Magnuson-Stevens, that fisheries managers act on science. The top Democrat on the Natural Resources Committee, Raul Grijalva of New Mexico, made that argument.
H.R. 1335 would take us back to the dark ages by gutting science-based requirements to rebuild overfished stocks and to set annual catch limits.
Among the new flexibilities, the bill removes the requirement of a 10-year stock assessment period for rebuilding depleted fisheries. Young says some regions of the country lack enough scientific data to adhere to rigid rules. And he says management councils should be able to respond more quickly to dynamic situations. Another controversial measure Young added to the bill says the regional fisheries management councils are responsible for reviewing environmental impacts and that no separate agency review is required. Critics say that would weaken a bedrock environmental law known as NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. Young says he believes it should all be handled by the management councils.
I'm trying to keep the legal beagles out of the fishing industry, where they've used the legal beagles for the environmental community to impede the fishing process and the proper harvesting of the fish and healthy stocks, and they've done that.
That provision is likely to disappoint tribal advocates in Alaska who claim federally managed fisheries are damaging salmon runs important to subsistence. Last year, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Kowarik, and the Association of Village Council Presidents wrote a letter asking Young to leave the NEPA process as it is because it gives tribes a stronger voice in fisheries management. Chris Oliver, executive director of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council in Anchorage, says he doesn't think the bill would erode the fundamentals of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, although he says his council is fine with the existing law.
We don't believe that the changes that they've put in the act are really likely to have any effect on how we manage fisheries in the North Pacific. I think it could allow for some legitimate flexibility in other regions and even perhaps in future situations in the North Pacific.
Young says he's still working on additions to the bills concerning subsistence and the community development quota program, so the bill is likely to be revised before the House votes on it. Now that the United States has assumed chairmanship of the Arctic Council, UAF's top two administrators say the University of Alaska Fairbanks will play a central role in carrying out the U.S. agenda in the region. UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers outlined that role last week during a live webcast of the Arctic Council meeting at the Murray Building on the campus's West Ridge. During the meeting, Canada formally relinquished the presiding role to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Rogers told a group-wide watching that as the nation's Arctic University, UAF has always been active in shaping and informing U.S. policy for the far northern regions. Roger says UAF's role will increase during the nation's two-year term heading up the Arctic Council.
This is a really important time for the University of Alaska Fairbanks as well. We have the expertise, we have the reputation to make significant contributions to support the work of the Arctic Council, to support Arctic policy and science generally.
Roger says UAF will see a lot of Arctic Council-related activity over the next 2 years. Upcoming activities include an Arctic Energy Summit and a Polar Law Symposium this fall, which will include sessions at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Roger says the Council itself will be meeting in Alaska over the next 2 years, and members of its delegations and its advisory panels will frequently be coming to the state, along with observers and non-governmental organizations that are associated with the Council. Even rural communities that have raised the money to build modern sanitation systems face the threat of their ultimate failure due to the lack of funding for operations and maintenance, wiping away whatever health gains were achieved. In the third segment of Kick the Bucket, KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Environmental Health and Engineering Department provides technical assistance to water treatment plant operators in the region, often meeting by teleconference.
I don't know if any of them are working.
Yeah, it's just a temperature sensor on the pump.
One of the issues that comes up is the lack of funding for minor repairs.
If we could spend $1,000 to save 24, it'd be great.
Big savings could be achieved by cutting energy use, 40% of operating costs. Kwithluk, also in southwest Alaska, is getting a new piped water and sewer system. At the new Kwithluk water plant, YKHC remote maintenance worker Bob White says new boilers used to heat water there use about half as much fuel as older ones, but he says they're out of reach for most villages.
And sometimes they just don't have the cash to make the jump to buy into the new equipment, to buy the new controls. This thing has a little computerized control that automatically has turned the boiler temperature down because it's warmer out today.
Back in 1995, the southwest Alaska village of Tuntutuliak got a new water and sewer system, too. Villagers saw dozens of homes fitted with tanks to store water and waste. Workers could deliver water and pick up sewage in tanks hauled by snow machines or ATVs. But resident Robert Enoch says water delivery stopped a few years ago.
The water delivery vehicles, the haul tanks, don't work anymore. The only thing that works is the sewer haul, the pump out systems.
That leaves villagers hauling water or ice for household use and cutting back to less water use than needed for frequent hand washing to prevent the spread of viruses and bacteria. Labor makes up 44% of operating costs, so the village hired only part-time workers. It charged people about 5% of the median household income. In some villages, fees are as much as 7%. Urban Alaskans pay less than 1%. But without the economies of scale that come with larger populations, the village couldn't replace equipment. And rural systems are aging out. Gavin Dixon is Rural Energy Project Manager for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Speaking to legislators from rural Alaska, he said the average age of rural water plants is 23 years, more than their expected design life of 20 years.
A lot of these systems are already at the end of their useful life. There are some of these plants operators don't even want to open or close valves because they're afraid that that would result in a catastrophic issue there.
YKHC Environmental Health and Engineering Director Brian Lefferts says the state government already supports energy, communications, and infrastructure. The only public utility, he says, that is not subsidized is water and sewer.
If we had something like power cost equalization for sanitation where people could pay rates similar to what they pay on the road system or on the rail belt communities, we'd have a lot more systems that are online and not struggling with the problems that they have now.
The state has long shared oil revenues with municipalities, and in many small towns and villages, those revenues make up the lion's share of local budgets. But with the price of oil half what it was a year ago, legislators have taken steps to end the municipal revenue sharing program that got its start in 1970, further reducing available funds for water and sewer operations and maintenance. There's got to be a better way. We'll hear about some proposed alternatives in the next segment of Kick the Bucket. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students to complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
New documents are complicating the biography of Anchorage mayoral candidate Amy Domboski. Court records show Domboski was enlisted in the Air Force shortly after high school, which she did not previously mention in detailed interviews about her resume. The documents brought to light in a post on the blog Mudflats Today show she was involved in divorce proceedings that ended in 1997. The documents include an order invalidating an earlier proceeding because of a forged signature. Spokesman David Boyle says the campaign does not have a statement regarding the documents. A British Columbia mine upriver from Wrangell and Petersburg is one step closer to full production after reaching a benefits agreement with a First Nations group last weekend. KSTK's Katerina Sestarek reports.
Red Chris is a copper and gold mine in the Stikine River watershed on the traditional territory of the Tahltan First Nation. The mine is one step closer to full production after Tahltan Central Council members overwhelmingly voted to enter an agreement with Red Chris. It gives them environmental oversight rights, jobs, and a share of mine revenue. The Red Chris mine is owned by Imperial Metals, which also runs the BC mine that spilled millions of gallons of waste into Canadian waterways last summer. The Mount Polly Dam spill spurred Tahltan members to request a third-party environmental review of the Red Chris tailings dam. Tahltan Central Council President Chad Day said the 22 recommendations made by the third-party review are either in place or being completed. Tahltan and BC officials have said the mine won't be granted a permit for full production until the Tahltan members are satisfied that environmental concerns have been addressed. Day said the benefits agreement does not amount to giving approval for the mine's final permits. He said the TCC's team of engineers and environmental experts will have input on all significant environmental permits for Red Chris. The mine has been operating with a temporary permit it received in February, shortly after an investigation found the Mount Polly Dam breach was caused by design flaws. Red Chris has been increasing production since then, and it made its first copper shipment from the Port of Stewart earlier this month. According to a TCC release, the mine is expected to reach production capacity this summer. Alaskans worry a breach at the Red Chris tailings dam could destroy salmon populations that spawn in the Stikine River and its tributaries and provide jobs and food for Southeast Alaskans. A group of Tahltan members set up roadblocks at the mine to protest construction last year, and Imperial Metals was granted an injunction to stop the protests. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katerina Sestarek.
YWCA Alaska is holding a gender pay equity summit tomorrow in Anchorage to focus attention on the wage disparity between men and women in Alaska. The YWCA is surveying and working with Alaska businesses to work on addressing the gender wage gap. Tamaya Liebersbach is the YWCA's Economic Empowerment Coordinator.
Nationally, we see about women making about 78 cents for every dollar that men make. And in Alaska, it's right around 67 cents. So anywhere from 67.4 cents to 67.8, depending on the stats you're looking at. So women do have higher average earnings than other women in, you know, different places in the U.S. But compared to men in Alaska, Alaskan women are very far behind.
One of the statistics that you list in some of the information YWCA has sent out is the difference that women physicians and surgeons make compared to men here. $62,000 less annually. This seems particularly bewildering. The degrees don't cost less for women, and they don't end up with a license to practice that's on mm-hmm. some sort of lower tier. What did you hear about the why? How do medical practices defend this type of disparity?
The biggest thing that we hear is that whether it's with physicians and surgeons, lawyers, any of those types of careers, that women leave to have children. And that causes them to kind of get their salary set back compared to men. And while that may be the case, at the Y, we really believe that what businesses need to look at is whether or not there's an equal opportunity for a father to leave when there are children, you know, or is that equally encouraged so that it really is a choice for a woman rather than it kind of being the assumption that the mother's going to leave.
Are there any signs of change in the Alaskan business world? Your survey is just in its pilot project right now, I understand, mm-hmm. but what do you see on the horizon?
So the statistics don't really show that much has changed. Since 1990, the pay gap has only closed by 5 cents. So it's barely moved. But I think that what we've seen is that there are a lot of companies, a lot of individuals who lead companies who want to move in this direction, who want to make workplaces more gender balanced and really make sure that they can recruit all of the talent that's out there, not just the male talent. And so another piece of our initiative is to have people endorse our goal of eliminating the gender pay gap by 2025. And right now we have 50 endorsers. We have a lot of companies who are supporting that goal, a lot of other companies who want to, you know, move it through their process and support that goal. And so I think that that's really encouraging.
Tamaya Liebersbach is an economist with YWCA Alaska. The day-long summit on gender pay equity is open to the public and happens tomorrow at the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Katarina Sestarik in Wrangell. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.